ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a variety of fascinating guests discussing the human side and impact of crime, not only on their lives, but mine as well. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, please contact Lifeline or any other support service or person that you feel comfortable with. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and not everyone will agree with them. I understand that and I hope you do too. Thank you.
You know, you never ever forget that sort of stuff. I could still draw a lot of those scenes out without having to refer to any notes or anything. You know, it's still very, very clear memories of those sort of things.
Well, hello, everybody. And yes, I'm back after a couple of weeks off, recharged my batteries. And I've been doing a fair bit of work finding some great guests for the next couple of months. Anyway, I know you heard Peter Bellion while I was away. That was a previous podcast that I'd done. But I've also done one recently with him. And it was because of the spate of bus and truck crashes of recent times here in Victoria and New South Wales. And it just made me think that it was time that we had another chat to this amazing man who was and still is most likely one of Australia's most knowledgeable experts in the field of major collision investigations. And, of course, I refer to Peter Bellion, the lovely Peter Bellion. And just a bit of a heads up, a warning, that today we're talking about road trauma and examination of those scenes. We're not talking so much about the horror at the scenes. It's more about examination of the scenes. Look, it just may not be suitable for some of you affected by road trauma. So just think if it's okay for you or how you are today at dealing with it. But Peter was an accident reconstruction expert with Victoria Police, and he spent most of his 30-year career measuring, photographing, reconstructing and providing expert opinion to the courts, to government bodies and organisations. He attended over 2,000 fatal car accidents and 20 police road deaths, and he was instrumental in the introduction of speed cameras here in Victoria, saving too many lives to put a number on, really. Peter was constantly exposed to gut-wrenching sadness and grief, which was present at every single one of those fatal accidents he attended, culminating in him being ill health retired in 2016 with chronic PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury. His bottle just overflowed. His bucket was full. He'd had enough. But Peter hasn't stopped loving what he did for 30 years, and he's still closely involved in many aspects of road trauma. And he has continued to be a fierce advocate in trying to keep us and our roads safer. Peter attended some of Victoria's most horrendous road fatalities, including the Kerrang rail disaster, in 2007 when a truck crashed into a passenger train, killing 11 and injuring 23 others. He was involved in the Burnley Tunnel, which he goes to in quite detail today. That was an inferno where a truck collided with several vehicles, resulting in an explosion and subsequent fire, killing 3 motorists. And the fatal crash that he attended of mammoth proportions in Cardross near Mildura, where 6 young teenagers were killed by a driver who ploughed into them as they walked along the road. So I wanted to chat to Peter about this spate of heavy vehicle crashes and just get some thoughts on him about what happens at scenes like this, how you manage the mayhem, the people rushing to help, the friends and family and acquaintances who arrive, often hysterical, wanting information and all very understandable responses. So, Pete, thank you yet again. For this is take 2, because we've had a recording, a podcast with you before, but I thought it was time we had you back. So thanks for joining us, Pete.
Thanks, Narelle. Glad to be here.
No worries. What have you been doing the last 18 months?
Keeping pretty busy. Been obviously with the president at the Port Melbourne Life Saving Club, so I've got over 1,000 members there. So I oversee the whole management of the club, basically, and the governance of the club, and do spend a lot of time on the beach keeping people safe. And I've also been flying drones for Life Saving Victoria as a remote pilot in their remote pilot aerial service over the mostly the peak part of summer.
Okay.
And some of the pre and post season stuff. So yeah, had 3 pretty unfortunate incidents that I had to go to this last season in regards to those. And I ended up doing, it was an 85-year-old guy that I pulled out of the water and turned out he had an aortic aneurysm and basically was full on hands on CPR for 20 minutes with him. So unfortunately he didn't make it, but he had 4 major incidents that I had where there was, you know, serious first aids. 3 of them were still alive and, yeah, 1 went, unfortunately. And I had a couple of nasty searches too where they weren't a good result. 1 at Gunnamatta and 1 down at Mordialloc. But, so rest in peace to those souls.
Gee, Pete, you can't get away from drama. I remember last time we spoke, the story still sticks in my mind about the man acting very strange on the beach and going into the water with a suit on or something a gun in his pants. I do apologise.
A gun in his in the side of the jean pocket underneath color of the suitcase. Yeah, it was about 4 years ago now. And, I did hear from the local police down at South Melbourne that that fine gentleman has now passed away. So anyway, there you go.
He was obviously a very troubled man. And look, I suppose
he was indeed.
And look, I wanted to get on to a few incidents that have been happening with the crashes. I suppose many of us have been in some. I'm just thinking now about the Hunter Valley wedding bus crash, and I suppose many of us have been probably in exactly the same scenario as that, where we've got on a bus but we've got home and back to our accommodation safely. And I just can't imagine the magnitude of a crash like that. For those who don't know, the bus was ferrying some wedding guests from the ceremony and celebrations to their accommodation nearby, and 10 people died in the crash. 9 at the scene and 1 in hospital. So, Pete, having attended so many chaotic and major scenes, I suppose I just wanted to ask you some generic questions about scenes, not about any particular one because some of them are still in the court system, but generally, can I talk a little bit about the scene? So what are the difficulties facing you as you would arrive at a scene like this that is obviously still chaotic, I assume?
Definitely, and probably a good example and something that has been through the courts was, you know, the Burnley Tunnel tragedy where 3 people incinerated in the Burnley Tunnel in Melbourne on Friday the 23rd of March 2007. So, you know, that that scene when I got there at 9:30, the Western Entrance Tunnel, it was absolutely chaotic. You know, you got there was something like 400 people there, and amongst those 400 were people that had been injured, people that were drivers of vehicles that were actually involved in the incident. There were people that were witnesses, and there was also the truck driver, as it turned out, that was the offending driver in the incident. So you're making some very, very quick decisions about what to do with all those people and who's going to, you know, deal with, for example, the offending driver, what needs to be done with him, what needs to be done with the witnesses. You know, they've got to be all separated, and so that their account of what has occurred is not clouded by another incident. You know, you want to try and get to them before anybody else has spoken to them, or so that you're getting their direct first account of what they saw and heard, rather than it being contaminated by questions or what other people have to say. You know, the injured parties, you know, you're arranging in conjunction with AV or Ambulance Victoria, you know, where they're going to, what hospitals they're going to, what their details are for catching up for later reference, you know, all that basic who, what, where, why, how and when. You know, and then in particular with that incident, you know, like because it was in the tunnel system, there's a number of camera systems. So you're looking to get that information from the camera systems as soon as possible to see actually what transpired. And then you would progress further down into, you know, the scene and, you know, make a very slow, measured approach to such a big scene to take in and absorb everything that you see on the way in. So, you know, you're looking at the road environment, you're looking at the weather conditions, you're looking at signage, you're looking at, you know, the characteristics of the road in terms of its design, its features and all that. And then you're getting into, you know, the start of any available physical evidence on the road, so which may consist of pre-impact tyre skid marks, tyre scuff marks, tyre yaw marks, it might be deceleration scuff marks, it might be anti-lock braking system skid marks. Then you might lead into an impact area where you've got scrapes or gouges or change in direction of marks. You've got potential transfer of underbody dirt or oil spatter onto the road surface commencing, and then you've got that sort of evidence then leading off post-impact to where, you know, the vehicles involved have finished up. So you're documenting all that evidence with measurements and photographs, and then you're getting to the vehicle itself and doing a fairly detailed examination of the vehicle in terms of, you know, where is the damage on it, what type of damage it is. You know, is it contact damage? Is it induced damage? Is it rescue damage? You know, then and you're looking at then detailed examination of wheels and tyres and what condition they're in, and suspension components, steering components, and then you're moving inside the vehicle and looking at where, what position are the controls in? What's the steering angle position? What gear is it in? What light switches are on? Radio things might be on. What is it fitted with? CB radio? Is it fitted with, you know, all these different things? And you're documenting and noting all that evidence as you're going along. And so, in particular,
so Pete, can I just interrupt there? So, is this, you have arrived at the scene, and are you sort of taking all this in as you make your way to the actual vehicle or the scene, and then you go back and record it properly? Like, I'm just wondering, are you recording it as you go, or you just
I would have my police diary or notebook, and I'd be writing things down as I went, and also taking photographs along the way as I make a note. And obviously more in this day and age, you know, if say, for example, the only thing you had was a mobile phone. You'd be taking photos on your mobile phone, and in the notes part on your mobile phone, you'd be making notes of what you're seeing, or you might even be recording things as you're walking down through the scene and recording what you're seeing and describing it. Yeah.
With 400 vehicles?
400 people there. Okay. Were at the western entrance of the Burnley Tunnel. Yeah, so they all had to be sorted out. Yeah.
Who was who. And so, Pete, with those, like, it sounds like chaos, and it would have been, obviously, but who is actually in charge of that scene initially when you get there? Like, do you take over as the MCIU, the Major Collision Investigation Unit, or is it the homicide? Just for the listeners, who is actually in charge? Because you must get a lot of, hey, I'm doing this, you're doing that. Like, who runs the show?
Obviously, with a major motor vehicle collision, the emergency management of a motor vehicle collision, the responsibility or overall control is the police. If there was a fire situation, or, you know, obviously rescue or treating the injured, obviously that takes priority first.
Yeah.
So when, until that component is done and dusted, then so the fire brigade, if there's a fire, they would have control at that point in time. Obviously, if there's mass casualties to get out, ambulance would have more of a say in that, because the priority is the getting the injured parties out. But once that aspect or the danger of the fire or the injured parties are removed from the scene, then the control comes back to the police, the overall management of that scene. So in terms of a major collision, you know, we'd have outer perimeters. So the outer perimeters, the control of that would be by either general duties or the highway patrol. And the inner perimeter, which is the actual scene of the incident itself or where the evidence is, the control of that would be predominantly in on behalf of the investigating police. And if it's a major collision, that would be the major collision investigation unit. So whether it be the sergeant of the team, but if it's a multiple fatality, three or more deceased, you'd also have the senior sergeant and the inspector there. So the overall control would come back to the inspector, major collision investigation group, if he was in attendance. Mm. If he wasn't, it'd be the senior sergeant. If the senior sergeant's not there, it comes back to the sergeant. So.
Okay, right. And did the coroner attend this one because of the number of fatalities?
Normally with a multiple fatality, the state coroner will come to the scene too. He might organise the chief pathologist also to arrive at the scene, and you would generally have disaster victim identification involved too, in terms of tagging and identifying the poor deceased people from the incident, and getting case numbers so that their identity is confirmed later on down the track.
Mm. So the MCIU are in charge of everything once all the injured people have been, seen to, taken to hospital, whatever. So, I mean, this is just an enormous scene. What is the most challenging part of a scene of this magnitude?
Oh, with multiple fatalities, it's obviously, each person that's unfortunately passed has a story to tell, and it's a big onus on the investigators to establish the truth of what transpired and what actually caused the death of that loved one. So when you're going through the scene, like in particular, let's talk about Miles Street Cardross on the 18th of February 2006, where the six teenagers were killed. You're in amongst those six deceased teenagers, and you're trying to establish exactly what's going on, and so you're actually documenting where they are, how they finished, what they're wearing. That you're trying to establish their identification, so you need to search in terms of have they got any ID on them. If they haven't, then there's other methods that need to be established, who they were, and then you're trying to establish, what it was that actually caused their death. So that's, and then, down the track, you've got you know, the death notifications to be arranged. You know, and you've got to relay that information to the families of the deceased, as, you know, it's not an easy task. And you're trying to do that with compassion and empathy. Mm. And then you'll have multiple contacts with those families as it progresses through various court proceedings, whether it be committals or trials or a coronial inquest. And, yeah, that's probably the most challenging, is dealing with the ripple.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Effect or the emotional side of those events, and over time it does build up, and as it did in my instance, and but it took, you know, obviously I was pretty resilient, like it was some 2,000 fatalities before the body basically said, "You've had enough's enough, sunshine. It's time to move on," sort of thing. Yeah.
And so, Pete, with the death message that you were talking about, that's the worst job, I believe. It's one of the worst jobs that a police person can have. Generally, correct me if I'm wrong here, it is the div man or somebody that goes and does the initial death message. But as an MCIU investigator, did you make yourself available to the families, or did you try and keep some sort of distance just so that you could, not sort of get too involved with that emotional, psychological side?
It just depends on the circumstances, you know, like, sometimes that occurred, but obviously there's always going to be a time somewhere down the track. And if for example it's a police member that would pass, and I remember going with Jeff Smith and myself, we're going to visit Dot Left Hook Tim's father Tim that was killed on the Western Ring Road, and you never ever forget that sort of stuff. I could sit down now, like, that was 1997 from memory. It was in May. And I could sit down and I could draw a picture of, you know, the house where Tim's parents were, and the room, and where they were seated, and, you know, that's pretty clear memories of all that sort of stuff. Or you know, times when, say, you know, Rennie Page, the policeman that was killed at Benalla, and I could still draw a lot of those scenes out without having to refer to any notes or anything. You know, it's still very, very clear memories of those sort of things. Yeah, so they never leave you altogether. And one of the things with police fatalities in particular is that you got the Blue Ribbon Foundation and all that, and there's it always pops up on your social media on the day. Like last week, for example, the 16th of August was where Gary Silk and Rod were killed in 1998, yeah. So, yeah. 25 years on, and that same date, Anne Brimblecombe, police foreman that was killed. So, that was certainly, certainly on the mind and in the memories on those particular days. And you get those little physiological reactions still, but you know what it is, and you manage it and you move through.
Yeah, that's true. And Pete, I know we're a bit pressed for time today. I wanted to just talk a little bit about seatbelts. I gather, would I be right in saying you've done a fair few studies regarding seatbelts, or you've certainly got experience at establishing if one was, worn or not? I just want to pick your brain.
You're doing detailed inspection of seatbelts that are involved in vehicles and crashes, and you're looking for those telltale signs on them to see whether they've been loaded up or not in a collision. Generally, you'll get stretching marks of fibres, or you get transfer of evidence on the metal tongue, on the person that's been involved in the crash. You'll have some sort of medical evidence or autopsy down the track that would show telltale signs whether seatbelts have been worn or not. And generally, if the seatbelt has been worn before somebody's been extracted, normally the ambulance service or the rescue service will do a clean cut through the seatbelt webbing, and you'll still find that they're buckled in. Most time, whereas if they haven't been, they're still all in peace and still in their retracted position and no sign of any evidence of loading or damage on them, and the body or the injured party won't have any telltale physical signs on their body, because as we know, every contact leaves its trace.
So enforcing compliance with seatbelt laws on buses is a pretty grey area. Who do you believe should be responsible for ensuring they're worn properly?
Well, ultimately, for seatbelts fitted, the individual in that seat is required to, wear that seatbelt and have it properly fastened and adjusted. Obviously, if the person's under 18, the onus comes back on the driver to make sure that's done. If the person's over 18, the onus or responsibility is the person themselves. So, we're in passenger cars, like your standard family sedan, we've got all seatbelt reminder systems in the modern car now that tells you when they're not buckled in, and will beep until they are buckled in. That's something that's not, as I'm aware, currently in your passenger coaches. Passenger coaches have had a requirement to have seatbelts in them for quite a while now. It was after the Wangaratta coach disaster where the 10 people killed on Melbourne Cup Day 1993 and the Boondall bus crash that Johnny Rule and my counterpart in Queensland AIS went to, that we went up to Canberra and spoke in regards to those incidents. And that was after that the mandatory fitting of seatbelts through Australian design rules came about in passenger coaches, but not necessarily in your general commuter bus. So if you're catching the bus to the station or something like that, generally that bus that travels down your side street to the local train station won't have seatbelts fitted. I know when my kids went through primary school, the local primary school, if a bus turned up that didn't have seatbelts fitted, they'd actually turn it away and request one that a coach that did have them fitted. So, then you got your smaller buses like 12-seaters and all that. They've had seatbelts fitted in for ages, and not everybody wears them though. And the problem is, if you don't wear them, for example, if I said to you, Narelle, go and run into that wall in that room you're in at 15 kilometres per hour, you wouldn't do it. And the reason you wouldn't do it, because it's going to bloody hurt. And in terms of human impact tolerance, once we get to 30 kilometres per hour, 15 out of 100 of us are going to die with that sudden stop from 30. And if it's up to 40, it's 50 out of 100. And as soon as it gets to 50, it's 85 out of 100 are going to die at that with a sudden stop, those speeds. So the idea of the seatbelt is to keep you restrained and gets you to slow down with the slowing of the vehicle, and you don't have that sudden internal stop inside the vehicle, because you know if you're unrestrained, you're loose and you're projected about, and then you're hitting something stiff inside the vehicle and not riding it down with the crush of the vehicle itself. You're having a very, very sudden internal stop when you fly into whatever object you hit.
If everyone was wearing seatbelts, clearly there would be a lot fewer deaths. Like, they obviously clearly save lives, and a lot of them.
Oh, yeah, been around for a long time, Narelle, and unfortunately the road toll this year, there's been quite a, I think some figures I looked at was looking at around about something like 20% of those killed in fatalities in vehicles haven't been wearing a seatbelt. And, like, mate, this is stuff that came in back in the, you know, lap belts came in the late 60s. They were mandatory to be worn and fitted, you know, from 1973 in passenger cars in Australia. There's been so many advances, and why the hell? And you see people that don't wear them properly. You know, they don't wear them over their shoulder. They have them underneath their armpit, and that's no good. You know, it's just not, why would you do that? They're there to save your life.
I'd have to say, Pete, would you, this is generalising, but would you say most of the people that don't wear seatbelts would be young?
No, I wouldn't. Okay. I wouldn't say that. Yeah, I think it's a bit of a mixture still. Yeah, not from my observations anyway.
Okay, yeah, like I was saying, maybe on. Obviously I'm generalising because I don't know, but we've had an incident here in Victoria recently involving a bus with 46 students on board.
Yeah,
you talk about the Burnley tunnel incident with 400 people, but I imagine with any incident involving that number of children, that would the level of chaos would just go through the roof, because, you know, you've got parents, and apparently this happened right near the school. So, like, I can't get my head around how traumatic that would be as an investigator to try and reassure people or tell them not to go near. You know, people are just wanting to go and see their kids, aren't they? I mean, how do you stop?
Yeah, well, look at the time, you know, when you're at one of those incidents, you're running off pure adrenaline and cortisol, and, you know, and you've got the ability to make some pretty amazing decisions at the time and do some pretty amazing things. And it's not until, you know, you come back home or later on that you sort of reflect on, wow, what did I just go to?
Yeah.
What did I just do?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's you do manage to control and manage even a big scene like that, but it's sort of afterwards where you go, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. How have you found media with the incidents that you've attended? And I'm not having a go at media here. Well, I probably sound like I am a bit, but they can be of great assistance, you know, helping in locate witnesses and vehicles. But they can also cause, in my instance, they have caused immeasurable damage to an investigation because they contaminate witnesses. They get them before we get to them. I'm just wondering, how have you found the media? I suppose they'd help you because you're trying to find dash cam or witnesses or whatever.
Yeah, the media, it's pros and cons to the media. They can be an invaluable asset in investigation, and I try to, you know, generally they're fairly good people. Obviously occasionally get the one that's sort of trying to make their career and probably dive down some tunnels that they probably shouldn't dive down. And, sometimes a nice quiet chat sets them back in the right direction. But, yeah, they can bring up, dust up some stuff that sort of, you know, does adds some ambiguity or does cause some dramas in investigation, and then you've got to go down a certain path to cover that aspect and find the truth of that aspect, which does take more time and resources when that does occur. But generally, you know, especially in a hit-run fatal, trying to, media assistance to, locate an offending vehicle is invaluable to get that message out.
It is, yeah.
And, in this day and age, it's all, you always say the thing, oh, has anybody got any dash cam footage? Well, it seems to be the standard line these days, but, yeah.
Mm. What about, you were talking before about going to a number of police fatalities. That would be a very, very difficult job to do. What would your advice to members attending those scenes be, attending a scene of a colleague?
It's never an easy task, and it's particularly at MCIU was something that we had to do. At the time when you're doing it, you're running off that adrenaline, cortisol, and you're doing the job that you have to do. And it's down the track or afterwards that you start reflecting on those sort of things. You know, like 20 police officer deaths that I went to, like, you know, you relate that back to, let's say I was a soldier in World War One in a trench and 20 of my mates were killed in one bomb blast or something like that. That's, you know, it's spread out over time, but it's that sort of thing. And you know, generally quite a few of those you knew from your careers. You know, like even there was one where I actually did, you know, the statement of ID for the coroner. And then you go back to like the four from Benalla Police Station that I went to, and I went back during the head-to-head walk in 2018 to set up Police Veterans Victoria, and you see those, you know, memorials out front of the police station there, and you go, wow, you know, I went to all them. Or you go to the police memorial wall and you see them all there, and priorities, you really got to sort of look after yourself, mate, you know. So if you are struggling, go and see your GP, have a chat, or do some psychological debriefing about what you've been to, and let it out of your system, and try and, you know, attend maybe the funerals or things like that to let those emotions come out of your body rather than boxing them up.
Yeah, that's really good advice. It would be nice if we would have had that, hindsight, wouldn't it, Pete, to look after ourselves properly, because we didn't, and we lost, I don't know about you, but the best job I ever had.
Yeah. Look, I love doing what I was doing, don't worry about that, but you literally get to the point where your body says, I can't do this anymore, and that's what happens. And like even just the Gunnamatta job with life saving earlier this year, you know, like you're there with the family when they called the search off and they had a ceremony, and yeah, pretty full on, but it was good to be involved in that little ceremony and let that emotional release out about, you know, you've been down there for 4 or 5 days trying to help find, a loved family member that has taken away. So, yeah.
It must give you enormous satisfaction, like you can't do policing anymore, but it sounds like your life-saving career, let's say, has sort of filled a bit of a void, because you're still involved to a degree, but certainly not, every single shift you're facing some sort of trauma. It must be very rewarding.
Yeah, well, generally the life-saving, you know, it's a positive experience, sunlight, water, people having fun. The downside of it is fairly minor in comparison to what I was doing in the past. But with life-saving, you know, we're doing a lot more, we do a lot more preventative stuff. And the idea is that, you know, we're there to prevent aquatic-related death and injury, and at the same time develop and mentor and create great young Australians. So it's a fairly positive movement, positive environment. So, yeah, it's ticked the boxes for me post-policing, yeah.
Yeah, and just how are you these days, Pete? Last time I spoke to you, you were really struggling with psoriasis and a fair few pretty serious health issues. How's the health these days? The mental health, I mean, and the physical.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's mental and physiological. Yeah, it's still ongoing management. You know, I still that 1 a.m. 2 a.m. period each night. I get hot and sweaty. Mm. Wake up. Normally get up and do a bit of stretching, bit of meditation, go back to sleep, you know, sort of thing. Psoriasis is still there. It's probably around about more than 20% of the body's got it on, but, you know, that's ongoing management. I've tried everything to get rid of it, but the best thing is the sunlight, salt water and on the skin, and, it is there, and manage it as best as I can and trying to keep doing positive things in life.
Oh, look, you are, Pete, when you consider what you do, you know, for, as you say, to teach people, not that I'm thinking little kids, but it's not just little kids, a lot of adults learn to swim when they get older as well. But it must be very, very rewarding, and thank goodness you've found something that, you know, you love just nearly, I imagine, as much as policing.
As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.